Our reading this morning is taken from the book of Amos, reading from chapter 4, verse 1 to 3, and then later on, verses 6 to 10. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan on Mount Samaria, you women who oppress the poor and crush the needy, and say to your husbands, bring us some drinks. The sovereign Lord has sworn by his holiness, the time will surely come when you will be taken away with hooks and the last of you with fish hooks. You will each go straight out through the breaches of the wall and you will be cast out toward Hamon, declares the Lord. I gave you empty stomachs in every city and lack of bread in every town. Yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. I also withheld rain from you when the harvest was still 3 months away. I sent rain on one town, but withheld it from another. One field had rain, another had none and dried up. People staggered from town to town for water, but did not get enough to drink. Yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. Many times I struck your gardens and vineyards, destroying them with blight and mildew. Locusts devoured your fig and olive trees, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. I sent plagues among you, as I did to Egypt. I killed your young man with the sword, along with your captured horses. I filled your nostrils with the stench of your camps, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord.
What do I have to do to get you to listen to me? I mean, seriously, what? That is my summary of the message of God to Israel in Amos chapters 3 and 4. The verses that Emmanuel just read, 6 to 10, you can hear the frustration building. Israel, you're my chosen people. You've gone off the rails. What does it take to get you back on track? You've had food shortages, droughts, floods, failed harvest, locusts, plagues and warfare, and you still haven't got the message. We didn't read chapter 3, but it's essentially a prologue where God says over and over again, things happen for a reason. It's not just random stuff. There's a purpose. There's a message. You know, very few passages of the Old Testament are aimed directly at a group of women. We can think of plenty of examples where God speaks to individual women, but not many where it's a group. So it's kind of a shame, but when he is speaking to a group, as he is at the start of Amos chapter 4, he's yelling at them. I mean, hear this word, you cows of Bashan, is not something you say in a nice, calm, reasonable tone of voice, is it? And yet, doesn't God love Israel? We know he does. He chose Israel. He delivered her. He protected her. He's always looking out for her. Okay, hot tip. If you know for sure that someone loves you, if he's chosen you, if he's obviously devoted to you, and then suddenly he yells at you, you should do what he says because there's going to be a thundering good reason. Over a lifetime of teaching, I've had many, many pupils ask me, Miss, when you got married, did you promise to obey your husband? And I always told them that I did, pointing out that half of the deal is the easy bit. I committed to obeying my husband and he committed to loving me as Christ loved the church and sacrificed himself for her. And I can truthfully say that in over 40 years of marriage, Graham has only ever once yelled at me. And he yelled, get out of the car. And I did. I didn't sit there saying, what for? Or who do you think you're talking to? I got out of the car and it's just as well I did because the car had just caught fire. We were at the start of the London to Brighton run and we never did get to Brighton, but we didn't go up in flames. Graham was able to cut off the fuel supply and we still have the car, in fact. When Amos yells at these women, when he yells at the Israelites in general about the terrible fate that's going to befall them, it's not because he hates them. It's not because God hates them. It's not fashionable to talk about the wrath of God, but God does get angry because he loves us. He gets angry at the damage that sin does to our lives. When he yells at people, it's because he wants them to move. He wants them to get out of danger before it's too late. And they didn't listen to Amos, and in the end, it was too late. Now, you'll be relieved to know that I don't think God wants to yell at us this morning. We are not the people the message was originally aimed at. But there's a reason why we have it here, preserved in the Bible. We are supposed to learn something from it. So I do think God means to challenge us. And unfortunately, when we're challenged, our natural human reaction isn't to listen and obey. Our natural human reaction is to defend ourselves. These women Amos is yelling at, don't you think they might have turned around and said, well, don't have a go at us. We're not the ones in power. We're not the decision makers in this society. Well, there might be a few injustices and inequalities. What do you expect us to do about it? And see, that's where we have something in common, because we could say that too. When God challenges us about injustice and inequalities in our society, when he tells us there are people in the world who are oppressed, there are people in so much need, they're just crushed by it. Yeah, we could turn around and say, we're not the decision makers. We're not in charge. We don't organize society to be the way it is. And yet, those women do have influence, don't they? Amos depicts them, in fact, as ordering their menfolk around, bring some drinks. If their husbands are taking that and not saying, what did your last slave die of? Then that tells me that these women probably do have some sway over things, how things are decided in their households. And they're not entirely innocent. They know the poor are being oppressed and the needy crushed. And they are part of the system that's doing the oppressing. And similarly, we should recognise that we are not without influence. Right? We're not the decision makers, but we have a vote. We don't organise the forced labour that makes cheap clothing or picks the cocoa beans for our chocolate or hand washes our car or paints our nails. But we do kind of know it's going on. And there are things we could do about it. And here is the good news. We can buck the trend. The problems of injustice and inequality in our society can be addressed. It's not all hopeless. Problems can be solved, and it's been done before. Quick whistle-stop time machine tour of the Five Valleys, 200 years ago. Most people in this region were living in abject poverty. They lived in cramped houses with no running water and poor sanitation, and in the winter they struggled to keep warm. They couldn't afford a doctor when they got sick. They couldn't send their children to school. They really didn't have much in the way of prospects. Work was hard, long hours for pitiful wages. You know why Egypt Mill is called Egypt Mill? It's because the owner, Nathan Webb, was such a slave driver. The workers nicknamed him Pharaoh and said they might as well be slaves in Egypt. A lot of people in this area resorted to petty theft. In order to survive, they would steal thread from the mills where they worked, and they were able to exchange it for goods in the local shop. It was currency. But if you got nicked for that or for poaching, you could get transported. And if you survived all that and lived to grow old, you could end up in the workhouse. So what transformed Stroud from largely a place of poverty and disease and petty crime to the mostly flourishing community that we see today? If we look at history, we can see there were three things. Number one, a passion for the gospel. People were praying. People were reaching out to their local communities. Look how many churches got set up in those 200 years. Stroud Baptist, Stroud Methodist, Stroud Congregational, good few Anglican churches too. I particularly like the fact that one of the churches that's just over 100 years old, St Albans, is in fact the old workhouse at the top of town. Secondly, individual generosity. Now, you know, God's heart is for the poor. If you get closer to God, you'll have a heart for the poor too. And if you want to get closer to the heart of God, go and stand alongside the poor and oppressed. That's where you're going to find him. Individuals were inspired by the gospel to dig deep into their pockets, to build schools, to pay the teachers, to provide medical care, to buy material and organise sewing parties so people could have warm clothes, to provide clean drinking water. Nailsworth Fountain is a monument to William Smith, who in the time of cholera brought pure water to the people of Nailsworth. And then three, there was political action. Because individual generosity can only go so far. If everyone is to have an equal right to free healthcare, free education, decent pay and working conditions, clean water, effective sanitation, and a state pension in their old age, that's got to be organised. And the way we organise it is what we call politics. It doesn't just happen. But it does happen when we collectively, as a society, do what God told the Israelites to do in Jeremiah, seek the good of the city where you live. To put it another way, don't just love your neighbour, love your neighbourhood. Now, as we return to our text of Amos 4 and seek its message for us, there are parallels, aren't there? Food shortages, floods, droughts, failed harvests, plagues, pandemics, global warming, rising sea levels, wars. You know, this is all the familiar stuff of today's news bulletins. A society, a world where a minority live in luxury and the world's poorest are crushed by a life of poverty they can't hope to escape from. That's a familiar picture to us. So where are we with these three remedies? Is there a passion for the gospel in the Five Valleys today? I think there is. I think Christians in our area are gathering to pray. They're reaching out. They want to see transformation. Is there individual generosity? Yes, we can point to many examples today. You know, launch an appeal, people respond. On the political action side, it's not so good, is it? I'd have to say we were drifting. Just had the local elections. I was at the count yesterday and people were saying, oh, that's quite a good turnout. And it was compared to most years. Some areas were even as high as, wait for it, 50%. 50% in a few areas, and that's considered good. That says that most of the voters in the Stroud Valleys are so apathetic about the state of the neighbourhood they live in, they couldn't even be bothered to vote. And as a society, we are accepting that, not seeing anything wrong with it. Now, this is an area where I think we Christians have got to make an effort to change the culture. Well, I mean, we actually call ourselves salt and light, don't we, here? SCF is part of the Salt and Light Christian Fellowship. What does salt do? It stops the rot. It gets worse, actually. On the subject of local elections, we didn't even have parish council and town council elections in most places. Stonehouse was the only one. There weren't enough people wanting to stand to make it worthwhile holding elections. Did anybody even notice that? Did anybody care? And then sometime when you've got a few minutes to spare, take a look at the websites of your local primary school and see if it has a full governing body. I checked four local primary schools while researching for this sermon, and three of the four have vacancies, and I'm on the board of a fifth local primary school that has vacancies on the governing body. And then you hear Christians say they can't get into some local primary schools. They don't get allowed in to take assemblies. No, but if they were willing to be governors, they'd get in no problem. Now, when did Christians withdraw from political life and stop seeking the good of the city in this area? You know, time was, it was normal, not remarkable, to be a Christian and engaged in politics. We revere the great social reformers of the past, Wilberforce, Shaftesbury. We know our political system in the UK was shaped by Christianity. Parliament still begins every day with prayer. It's not compulsory prayer, but there is prayer at the start of every parliamentary session in the morning. And here's a fun fact I discovered while researching for this sermon. Did you know when the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition stand at the dispatch boxes, they're standing actual boxes with something in them? What's in them? Bibles. And yet, if we said our parliamentary system today was notable for having the Word of God right at the heart of it, I mean, we would be lying. We do not see that in our parliament today. And we've been drifting. We didn't notice. We used to have standards in public life, even just within the last 20 years. There's been a shift. Back in 2003, when Tony Blair was accused of lying to Parliament, it was a major deal. And that's right. It should be if somebody is accused of lying to Parliament. That is a serious thing. You know, an Italian friend of mine said to me at the time, oh, he's in trouble now. The English don't like it if their politicians lie to them. And I said, what? The Italians do like it. They like being lied to. And he said, no, we don't like it, but we've come to expect it. And at the time, I thought, how tragic. And now, once again, we have a Prime Minister accused of lying to Parliament repeatedly and of taking bribes, the tune of 50 grand to do up his apartment, which allegedly he hastily paid back when the story was uncovered. And here is the crucial point, because I am not here to say he's innocent or guilty, but it bothers me deeply that his ministers do not defend him by saying he's innocent, but by saying, well, it doesn't matter. The voters don't care about that. What? Well, God cares, doesn't he, if there's corruption at the heart of government? You can't read the Old Testament and not work that one out. People, if you do nothing else as a result of this talk, I urge you, do this one thing. Write to our MP and tell her, or if you're outside the Stroud catchment area, write to your MP and tell whoever it is, that we do care about standards in public life. I mean, this is not about party politics. It's not about who you voted for. This is, to quote the motto of Christians in politics, kingdom above tribe, whoever's in power. We want to be able to hold our heads up and say our politicians don't take bribes. Who cares if they take bribes or not? Here's another area where I think our society is drifting along, not noticing. During lockdown, we naturally focused on protecting our older citizens. Fair enough, but we took our eye off the ball where the younger ones were concerned and the predators moved in. In 2020, 39% of all robberies in the UK were committed by youngsters aged between 10 and 16. Older criminals were finding it harder to commit crimes during lockdown because they were a bit conspicuous, so they recruited the kids to do it. And once the child has been recruited by a criminal gang, it's very hard to get them free of it. We need a massive investment in our youth services. And this is, you know, not something that's suddenly gone wrong. Youth services in Gloucestershire have been failing inspections for years. There is stuff we can do to support struggling families and stop the kids going off the rails in the first place. It's not rocket science. It's working when people actually do it. And lastly, I'd like to say something about water and sanitation. This planet is not short of water. 3/4 of it is covered by sea. We all learned that at geography at school, didn't we? And in drinkable form, water falls out of the skies for free. We know how to catch it, store it so we don't get floods and so mosquitoes don't breed in it. We know how to transport it too, and we know how to deal with human waste to avoid disease. And it's all pretty cheap and simple. So how is it that in this year of grace 2021, there is anybody on God's earth who doesn't have access to clean drinking water and adequate sanitation? How have we in the developed world drifted along and let that happen? Not enough people care. Well, God cares. The voice of Amos cries to us from nearly 8 centuries BC. People staggered from town to town for water, but did not get enough to drink. Yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. We're just cutting our foreign aid budget here in the UK, and we are going to be spending 60% less than we did before on water and sanitation. So we're going to be like the cows of Bashan and tell our husbands' wives to go get us a drink. Actually, there is nothing wrong with coffee after the service, okay? Feel free to have your hot drink. But there is something wrong when we who can freely turn on the tap and get pure water aren't being a voice for the people who cannot yet do that. We must think about the oppressed and the crushed and the needy. So there we are. To get close to God's heart, get close to the poor. Justice for the poor is achieved by a combination of prayer, generosity and political action. And to love our neighbours better, we must start loving our neighbourhoods better. I hope that God has challenged you to do something today. I hope you're going to do it.